I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Moderate Republican Olympia Snowe of Maine says she will break with her party and become the only member of the GOP to vote with Democrats on a compromise health care bill that she helped broker with Senate Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus of Montana.
So is this bill all that I would want? Far from it. Is it all that it can be? No. But when history calls, history calls.
That's Olympia Snowe speaking just minutes ago. Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, there was some tension earlier this morning, some thought that Olympia Snowe might not support the bill. Her support does come with some caveats, but what's their sense of what she said?
Very important. She said one thing that you or your listeners haven't heard yet. She said, my vote today is my vote today. And I think all of the members are signaling that they know that the bill they're voting out isn't what the Senate is going to vote on finally. That's going to be determined behind closed doors. And so you're seeing a real push right now from the members who still are somewhat on the fence with this final bill to make their final pitch. You heard from her. She wants to make sure that this is affordable and that rural Mainers can afford to pay for something. But you also heard from Republicans. Or from Democrats like Senators Rockefeller, Wyden, Lincoln, all with, you know, voting with it this time, but with serious reservations that they want to stay in the thick of the negotiation.
We'll take Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia for a start, because he, on the other side of the fence, says the bill, which mandates insurance coverage but doesn't create a public option that he wanted, it falls short on that. But he would still vote for it when the vote is taken, even though it doesn't have the public option he wants?
That's right. It's a step in the right direction, he said, and that is the theme that all of the Democrats are sounding. Let's keep this process moving, but we're reserving judgment for what we see on the floor. Rockefeller is very concerned that the insurance companies are not going to deliver more affordable policies, quite the opposite, and he points to a report they released over the weekend that suggests that policies will actually increase. As evidence that you can't depend on them, you need a public option.
Well, this is the insurance industry report. They put that out predicting dramatic increases in some premiums because they were angry.
That's
that
right.
They'd made a deal. The government was supposed to require everyone to get insurance, and then with so many newly insured, the insurance companies would make a lot more money. So they agreed to a requirement they'd have to cover people despite previous conditions. Now they say the deal was changed. The new bill's watered down, fewer penalties for people who don't get insurance, and the insurance companies say they feel that means people are going to wait, get sick, and then still get insurance because the insurance companies have been required to cover them even if they're sick with previous conditions.
Exactly. You heard two very interesting things from the kind of bean counters in the room, the Congressional Budget Office, for example, who said it is our assumption that any fee on insurance companies, for example, on medical providers, will simply be passed on to consumers. And in another, I think, quite startling revelation, I mean, it's been there all along, but it hasn't been really clear to the public, is that the CBO has never done an estimate on whether or not health costs for Americans will go up or down as a result of this plan. They've looked at what will happen to government. Government won't be hurt by it. In fact, they'll see an $81 billion surplus if all laws stay the same. But they have not done what they've done for every previous health bill, which is to also see what the impact will be on consumers. Why haven't you done it, Republicans said repeatedly. Answer, because it's too complicated and we didn't have time.
Yeah.
Very important point.
Right, and we now see the argument being laid as we go forward. The insurance companies saying that premiums are going to go up because they'll pass the costs on, and people like Jay Rockefeller saying, well, that's exactly why we need the public option for those people who need government insurance, and also perhaps sending out the flag, you know, you better not raise the premiums. Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, thanks so much as we dip our toe in this, you know, quickly moving, still moving stream on health care reform. Gail, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, looking back, remember that woman who confronted Congressman Barney Frank at a town hall meeting about health care this past summer?
Why do you continue to support a Nazi policy, as Obama has expressly supported this policy?
That woman comparing Barack Obama's health care reform to Hitler's T4 euthanasia policy. Barney Frank asked her what planet she was on, and then everyone seemed to move on to the next news cycle. But it turns out that woman was a follower of Lyndon LaRouche, the leader of the movement that's been called a cult, and most people thought it completely died out. And according to our next guest, the LaRouche movement, the John Birch Society, other fringe groups on the radical right are not only alive and well, they're part of a hijacking of the Republican Party. We think of Rush Limbaugh and Fox News' Glenn Beck as the right's leaders. Max Blumenthal says, look to R.J. Rush Dooney and Francis Schaeffer. Max is author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. He's also senior writer for the Daily Beast. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Max, welcome.
Great to be here.
Let's start, because you start in what would seem an unlikely place, the birth in 1916 of a man named R.J. Rush Dooney. Who was he?
R.J. Rush Dooney was a survivor of the Armenian Genocide, and after coming to the United States, he concluded that secular civilization was fallen and had to be replaced with a hardcore Calvinistic theocracy. So he mapped out a plan for replacing America's secular constitutional government with a theocracy based on biblical law, so that all of the government's functions, from road building to schooling to health care, would be replaced by the church. And the criminal justice system would be based on Leviticus case law, so that disobedient children, blasphemers, abortion doctors, and homosexuals would be all executed. And while Rush Dooney might sound like an extreme figure, his book, The Institutes of Biblical Law, provided the Christian right with this blueprint for replacing secular society and secular government with the theocracy at the time when the movement was moving from the pews into the streets.
Well, you say that his ideas were picked up in the 50s and 60s by Southern pastors in particular, who were rankled by the forced integration of public schools, including Jerry Falwell from Lynchburg, Virginia. But you also say some alarms went off on the right. Two of Falwell's lieutenants thought Rush Dooney was scary because he called for the death penalty for alcoholics and homosexuals. By the way, how did Rush Dooney respond to that?
Rush Dooney responded, "This is a scurrilous attack. I never advocated executing drunkards. As for the rest of them, well..."
Well, he befriended a retired candy manufacturer, Robert Welch, who was behind the right-wing fringe group, the John Birch Society. He was also, Rush Dooney, ultimately funded by Howard Amundsen. Who was he?
Well, Howard F. Amundsen Jr. is the sugar daddy of the Christian right. His father, Howard Amundsen Sr., is a famous philanthropist from California and the founder of Washington Mutual. And when Amundsen Jr. was 18, he inherited $300 million from his father. His mother died soon after, and he was left alone in a mansion. Rush Dooney became something like a surrogate father to him, and Amundsen became Rush Dooney's financial angel. And all of the initiatives that he's funded have to be seen in that context, from the intelligent design movement, which Amundsen has funneled millions into, to Proposition 8 that banned same-sex marriage in California, which Amundsen pumped at least $1 million into. Yeah.
Well, you know, we're going to ask you, what's wrong with that? Some might say this is just somebody funding what he believes in. But before we do that, let's just pull one other thread, that of Francis Schaeffer. He was a countercultural favorite in the 60s, Led Zeppelin's Jimmy Page carried his writings. You tell us Bono later was a fan. Then in 1973, Francis Schaeffer snapped over abortion.
Well, Francis Schaeffer was the leader of this Christian hippie commune in the Swiss Alps and had fostered this tolerant environment and been a mentor to even open homosexual Christians. And suddenly, with the ruling of Roe v. Wade, he snapped and went to Washington and began to evangelize the Republican leadership there, using abortion as a wedge issue. But at the same time, Schaeffer went too far. And by the end of his life, he was advocating domestic terrorism, giving rise to groups like Operation Rescue, which recently a member of Operation Rescue assassinated Dr. George Tiller in Kansas.
Well, this isn't just your opinion. We know a lot of where this thread goes because of Francis Schaeffer's son, Frank, who says today that his father was calling for the overthrow of the government. Tim LaHaye, who writes the Left Behind series, Pat Robertson, James Dobson of Focus on the Family, these were all followers. Dobson said in 2002, "Thank God for Francis Schaeffer. He made the connection between abortion and euthanasia." And Schaeffer had been, as you said, a progressive.
And Schaeffer saw the irony of this as he was dying of cancer in the early 80s. He began to refer privately to his Christian right followers in this movement he had created as the low IQs. He believed that they worshipped ignorance. He believed that Pat Robertson was pathologically insane and that James Dobson was a power monger. And he wanted to denounce them, but it was too late.
Well, let's do another branch on the tree. Chuck Colson, who was the Nixon dirty trickster who had a jailhouse conversion and founded a prison ministry, was a fan of Rush Dooney's thinking and of Schaeffer's anti-abortion crusade. Let's stop there for a second, because a lot of people are uncomfortable with abortion. So where did this lead to in your mind that becomes a problem for the Republican Party?
Well, I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with attempts to, you know, skirt constitutional provisions on the separation of church and state, and a lot of people are uncomfortable with domestic terrorism. Chuck Colson, after he came to Jesus, he founded a group called the Prison Fellowship, which is a multi-million dollar organization that operates with public funding in several states. And he goes into prisons and deliberately evangelizes prisoners. And these programs have been ruled unconstitutional, for example, in Iowa. And Colson's agenda comes from Schaefer and from Rush Dooney. Francis Schaefer's influence on Colson is most apparent in a science fiction novel Chuck Colson wrote in 1995 that follows a band of Christian guerrillas who are attempting to stop the National Institutes of Health from harvesting brain tissue from aborted fetuses to cure AIDS. To stop this evil plot, they launch a killing spree of abortion doctors and eventually firebomb the National Institutes of Health. It's no surprise that Colson's novel has been excerpted at length on the website of the Army of God, which is a radical anti-abortion group responsible for the killing and bombing of dozens of abortion providers. So I think there's a real problem here in the image that Colson tries to affect as this benevolent prison reformer.
You write about then-Republican presidential nominee Dwight Eisenhower in 1952, who had silently watched Joseph McCarthy. He was made uncomfortable. He distributed a book to his friends called The True Believer by Eric Hoffer. And in writing about Eisenhower, you sort of foreshadow what he might have been afraid might happen to the Republican Party. What did he want people to read in the book?
Well, when I was researching my book, I found this letter by Dwight Eisenhower to a veteran of World War II who was dying of cancer. And the veteran had written Eisenhower that he sought a leader who speaks directly to the people with total certainty. And he used his response to this letter to expound on his vision of the open society, recommending a book called The True Believer, An Analysis of Extremism. The book is by Eric Hoffer, a self-educated longshoreman who became a philosopher in his spare time. And Hoffer's thesis is that faith in a holy cause is really a substitute for lost faith in ourselves. And Eisenhower warned the veteran that those seeking relief from the mental stress and burden which democracy imposes will find refuge in extremist movements that offer them freedom from the necessity of informing themselves and making up their own minds concerning complex and difficult questions. Eisenhower was referring to the radical right, which was attacking him at the time, especially the John Birch Society, which had labeled him a communist operative, just as the groups that grew out of the John Birch Society label Barack Obama a Stalinist or a Hitlerian figure.
We're speaking with investigative journalist Max Blumenthal in his new book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. He lays out his claim that the Republican Party has been hijacked by the radical Christian right, with roots in the teachings of anti-abortion activist Francis Schaefer and R.J. Rush Dooney, who advocated replacing the federal government with the Christian church and killing homosexuals. But, Max, Republicans have been speaking out against the new faces of the right. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham recently said Glenn Beck of Fox News, who promoted the National Tea Party protests, doesn't represent the Republican Party and was unfair and not good for the country. Former Bush speechwriter Peter Wenner said that Beck's broadcast should worry the conservative movement. And former Republican Congressman, now MSNBC host Joe Scarborough, said you can't preach hatred, you can't say the president's racist, as Beck did, you can't stir up things that could have very deadly consequences. So, Max, are you painting the Republican right with too broad a brush? Because you've said that the far right succeeds because they appeal to people in personal crisis who turn to ideology to keep their own impulses at bay, and so subsequently have senators arrested in men's bathrooms. But aren't there people, Republicans, who genuinely are against abortion or extramarital sex? And for them, this isn't some psychological refuge.
I'm sure there are. I'm not trying to paint the movement with a broad brush. My book is a journalistic profile of certain figures who have brought the Republican Party into the grip of a radical right-wing movement.
Well, one of them, you say, is James Dobson. In 1977, he founded the evangelical group Focus on the Family. There are fascinating offshoots to his story. His early patriarch was Edgar Prince, the auto parts magnate who found God after a heart attack, and whose son, Eric Prince, was an intern for Focus on the Family and then became founder and CEO of the mercenary firm Blackwater, a name familiar to many. Dobson's lobbying arm is the Family Research Council. He was behind the Republican Congress Revolution in the mid-90s. But why else do you focus on him?
The reason that I focus on him, besides the fact that he was directly responsible for the re-election of George W. Bush in 2004 and the rise of the Republican Congress, is because he has cultivated the sensibility that defines the movement that controls the Republican Party through exploiting this culture of personal crisis. In Dobson's Focus on the Family, in his mountain kingdom in Colorado Springs, in the basement is a correspondence department that's so large it has its own zip code. The correspondence department handles thousands of pieces of mail and phone calls every day from average Americans seeking help for mundane problems, from marital strife to pornography addiction. And they receive Dobson-approved advice, but then they're entered into a data bank. And they're bombarded with political mailings informing them that the real source of these societal problems are the homosexual agenda, abortion, liberalism, feminism. And they're converted slowly into Republican shock troops because they view Dobson almost as a magic helper who's restored their personal lives to normal, and they owe him. Dobson has used this flock to destroy the political ambitions of moderates from Colin Powell to Bob Dole.
Well, some would say, you know, this is America, you can have a flock, but maybe more offended by his entree to Washington. You talk about a time when Dobson summons 25 House Republicans for a meeting in the Capitol basement and says he's going to bolt from the party unless they accede to his demands, from eliminating the National Endowment for the Arts to defunding Planned Parenthood. And you quote then-Majority Leader Dick Armey as whimpering, but it's a quote, "I was never so wrongfully and viciously attacked in all my 18 years in Washington as I was by the Christian leaders." I mean, you tell of many times when James Dobson has literally said to Republican leaders, "This is what I want."
He had so much access to the new class of leadership in the Republican Congress because he had converted so many of these figures. Steve Largent, who is an emerging member of the class of 94, was Dobson's hunting buddy. Jim Talent was a reformed Jew who said he heard Dobson's voice on the radio, pulled over by the roadside with tears streaming down his face, and promptly converted to evangelical Christianity. Gradually, Dobson began applying pressure on Newt Gingrich, who was not conservative enough for him, eventually forcing a vote of no confidence and ousting Gingrich, who by the time he was leading impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton was having an affair with a woman 20 years his junior who would eventually become his third wife. And when Gingrich sought to return into the political fray, he appeared on James Dobson's radio show in 2007 because he needed Dobson to welcome him back.
And by the way, James Dobson is not a minister.
He has no theological credentials. He's a child psychologist, and he understands that behind the politics of resentment of the right is a culture of personal crisis. And so he's used this dynamic to assert himself politically.
Max Blumenthal, have you heard from moderate Republicans, having written the book?
I've been on book tour, mostly on the West Coast, and I've met dozens of moderate Republicans who told me that they've left the party because the Republican Party has gone beyond them. And I've watched as Olympia Snowe, one of the last moderate Republicans in Congress, has said the same thing. I received an email from Susan Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower's granddaughter, complimenting my discussion of her father's warning against the radical right. And so I think the moderate Republicans do not exist anymore, which means that the Big Tent Party of Dwight Eisenhower is now the one-ring circus of Sarah Palin.
Well, and are you hearing from her supporters and, you know, current Republicans when you're out speaking?
I am. At a recent event at the University of California, Riverside, a group of college Republicans attempted to prevent me from speaking. And when I did a panel discussion with an openly gay progressive activist and an African American, they heckled the openly gay man, blowing kisses at him, and accused the African American of being a racist, much as Glenn Beck has accused Barack Obama of being a racist. They reminded me of the mobs that have been disrupting town halls. What they seek is not only the delegitimization of the Obama administration, but the disruption of civic society, because they see the sun setting on the party that they control. And this is their death rattle. And I expect more disruptions like this in the future.
Max Blumenthal, senior writer for the Daily Beast. His book is Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. Max, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Doctors are warning parents to be on the lookout for signs that swine flu has taken a deadly turn in their children. While experts say H1N1 isn't any more dangerous than seasonal flu, children do seem to be catching it more, and hundreds of thousands of them have likely been infected. And now the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report that 19 children died from swine flu last week alone. So how can you tell when it's become deadly? Dr. William Schaffner is chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at the Vanderbilt School of Medicine. Dr. Schaffner, we're seeing these stories of children. They come down with flu, die very quickly. And we understand this happens when the flu leads to other illnesses. Explain that.
Yes, that's right. The swine flu virus will get down into your chest and upset the mucous membranes of your bronchial tubes that go down into your lung. And then that can be further complicated, that inflammation, by bacterial infection, which can lead to pneumonia.
Right. And we understand that it can also happen just when you think your child is getting better. So give us some of the signs.
If your child is getting better and then suddenly stops getting better and seems to be getting worse, that's a good sign. If their breathing becomes troubled or too rapid, if they develop a bluish skin color, if they stop drinking and become dehydrated, and then, of course, if their personality changes, if they become exceedingly irritable, and certainly if they become difficult to wake up, any of those things should get you to a doctor with that child quickly.
So to be clear, your child can have the flu, be sick, start to get better, and then maybe relapse. In that relapse, by the way, I want to talk more about the symptoms you listed, but is one of the symptoms a fever?
Yes, it could well be that the fever, which has been going down, now comes back up. That
okay.
should be a warning sign.
Well, and tell us about some of the other signs, and the one that jumps out, because it seems like the one that may be different from just other childhood illnesses, is the bluish finger and skin color. What is that?
That would go along with having so much lung involvement that they're not getting enough oxygen into their lungs and into their bodies, and so they develop this bluish skin color, which we call cyanosis.
I don't mean to be flip, but is this something you'd also see in children of color?
You can see it around their mucous membranes in their conjunctivae.
And what's it, conjunctivae?
The conjunctiva is in the interior of their eyelids. You know, that's usually very pale. Mm-hmm. That can take on a bluish complexion. And some of the children can get bluer around, darker around their lips.
Mm-hmm.
And their fingernail beds can become bluish. And they're normally quite pink.
So what happens if you see these symptoms? Because we're hearing stories of parents rushing children to the emergency room and it becomes too late.
What we have seen is that parents have a tendency to delay, oh, this child will get better again, or I don't want to trouble the doctor.
Well, and because we hear that the last thing you want to do is bring a child, for instance, to a doctor's office and or emergency room where there's so many germs.
We need to distinguish a child that has suddenly become ill for the first time and is miserable but doing well. Call your doctor. Don't take that child. But if that child can't take liquids and is clearly having trouble breathing or changes their personality and becomes very irritable or difficult to arouse, those are signs that should alert a parent that mm-hmm. something's not right.
And will medications at that point help? Can Tamiflu at that point help?
We would give that child Tamiflu. We might have to give them some fluids intravenously. We might admit them to the hospital, put them in even in the intensive care unit if they are sufficiently ill.
Yeah. Well, we keep hearing that swine flu isn't really any worse than seasonal flu, except that it seems to be affecting children more. 76 children have died from swine flu since April. Only 68 children died in the entire past year of seasonal flu. What is happening there when it comes to children?
It's just two messages. Let's say out of 300 children, 299 will do very well, but that 300th child, that's the one who's going to get sick and get seriously ill. So we all need to be alert to pick that up at the earliest possible moment.
Dr. William Schaffner, infectious disease expert at the Vanderbilt School of Medicine, with the latest on detecting swine flu in your child. Dr. Schaffner, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Okay, and we'll be back in 30 seconds with a look at the future of the American farm through the eyes of an African-American farmer in North Carolina. In 30 seconds, here and now. The average American farmer is almost 60 years old, and many are wondering if their farms will survive another generation. For their daughters and sons, the question is, why farm? In our series, Five Farms, we're profiling farm families across the country. Today, Eddie and Dorothy Wise. They raised hogs on 106 acres in Nash County, North Carolina. Eddie didn't inherit his farm. He says that after a 27-year career in the Army, he returned to his native North Carolina and for 5 years in the 90s fought with a racist local government loan officer before he could eventually buy it. So a fourth-generation black farmer, he became the first in his family to own one.
My grandfather would be proud as hell from a standpoint that he was a sharecropper. Everybody else, to include my uncles, they couldn't wait to get off the farm. We're never coming back. I ain't never wanted to leave the farm. My heart has always been in the farm.
Eddie and Dorothy Wise have three children, and they always intended to leave the farm to their kids in the hope they'd keep it in the family. But none grew up on farms. All have careers elsewhere. It's a challenge that's especially wrenching for African Americans. Keeping a farm kid on the farm is hard enough, but finding the next generation of farmers among young people with little experience on land can seem almost impossible. Our story was produced by John Bewin.
But we must change and we must work together to preserve what we're going to call our preferred future. Thank you.
I'm Eddie Wise, and we are at the 6th annual Black Land Loss Summit and Conference. And the location is the Hilton in Raleigh, North Carolina.
The North Carolina Minority Farmers Association meets basically here every year. My name legally is Dorothy Joanetta Monroe Wise, and Eddie and I come every year and we meet new people, but the old ones come on and we have a lot of fun together.
We had 90% of the black farmers in North Carolina that are actually farming present. I brought 350 flyers from each of my stores, and we ran out of flyers. So I know it was at least 350 people here.
Moving right along, if you need some good hogs, I have some.
This conference combines socializing, sharing ideas, a lot of detailed information on what can be done to help us survive on the farm.
So my name is Amy Davey. I'm an attorney at the Land Loss Prevention Project in Durham. That's part of why you're here, is trying to figure out how to make sure that what you've already gotten from the previous generation or you've worked really hard to purchase for yourself, you can find ways to keep that wealth in the family, because land is wealth. And sometimes we don't think about
it. Our plan is something happens to myself or something happens to Eddie, my son and his son will equally get whatever we have. It's theirs with no problem.
As you look at black farmers, when their kids grow up and move off the farm, they don't come back, want to come back, because daddy had such a hard struggle. My name is Carl Bond. I'm the farm loan manager to service Martin, Wayne, Green, and Pitt County. And Mr. Wise is one of the customers I serve from Nash County. I am a second-generation farmer. My father farmed. But when I retire, I'm going back to the farm. And in order for a young black man to go back to the farm, or a middle-aged black man to go back, he has to grow up on the farm. He has to really see the struggles and understand what's going on. And a lot of young people do not get that opportunity to do that.
Mr. Wyatt, I think for next year's session, we need to target what our young kids can do to get into 4-H. There's a link with 4-H that we as black people have not been advised that we need to be doing with our kids. If you're a hog farmer and you got a neighbor that's got young kids, get them participating, for instance, just to show a hog for a year. He grows the hog and show him. This lays the foundation for him as a farmer.
We have to instill in our young people today that farming is a business, and they need to understand the value of the farmland. If they don't understand that, it's just a way of quick money for them to do other things and not a way of life, then we won't have any black farmers left in 20 years. Because all the old heads, the smart farmers are going to be gone.
We're in the backyard, in the trees between the lake and the house, close to the picnic table where the dogs are stretched out relaxing in the sun, sunning. Raking up some pine straw to put around my lilies. I have candle lilies, and they won't winter over unless you wrap them up and protect them. And this will protect them to the spring. I don't do the 5 miles with the rucksack every day, but I'm handling 100-pound bags of corn. And as you notice, I handle a few 100-pound pigs and 50-pound pigs, moving them from pen to pen. So I get in a lot of exercise. So I'm in pretty good condition. I don't think I'm too bad for a 65-year-old character running a farm full time.
That's Eddie Wise, a farmer in Nash County, North Carolina. His epilogue? Well, Eddie says he hopes to farm for another 10 years or more. His son, a 42-year-old police officer in D.C., says he knows how much his father's farm means to him and would hate to see it sold outside the family, but he's not ready to say he'll take it over when his father can't run it. Their story is part of our series, Five Farms, from Wesley Horner Productions and the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. For more, go to our website, herenow.org. Okay, quick question. Remember this song from 1991? Well, you probably never heard it. It's called I Never Heard. It's by Sapphire. And Michael Jackson's estate had never heard it either when they released Michael's recently discovered and much ballyhooed song, This Is It, this week.
This is it. Here I stand. I'm the light of the world. I feel grand.
They are, of course, the same song, co-written by Jackson and Paul Anka in the 80s. Yesterday, Anka said he'd sue. Now that the Jackson family has given him credit and a portion of the royalties, not to mention a showcase for Sapphire's version, all is forgiven. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back.
My Broadway debut was one of the highlights of my life. But at the same time, being that young, I wasn't quite as aware of how lucky I was. So I'm glad I got a second opportunity to go back and really embrace it.
That's actor Jude Law talking about his second opportunity to come to Broadway in an English production of Hamlet. The Great White Way is witnessing its perennial invasion from across the various ponds this fall. Joining Jude Law, two actors better known as superheroes, Britain's Daniel James Bond Craig and Australia's Hugh Wolverine Jackman, star in A Steady Rain. Here and Now critic at large Ed Siegel joins us to talk about those productions and a few others. Ed, welcome.
Nice to see you, Robin.
And, you know, what is the American love affair with everyone else's theater, but I guess more accurately, British theater?
You know, to some extent, it's an inferiority complex. They grow up with theater in their blood the way that we grow up with movies and TV in our blood. So to an extent, it's deserved. But there's a larger economic issue. The way that Broadway works today is, for a serious play, you almost have to do it someplace else and get Broadway's attention. And London has become maybe the primary place for that to happen.
Because it's too expensive. People don't want to gamble.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Hamlet did have a well-received run in England, and for, you know, that's a tough audience.
That's right. And the Donmar Warehouse is where it was produced, and they have become known for matching great actors who we know primarily from the movies with great stage roles. Kevin Spacey in The Iceman Cometh was one example. Mm-hmm. And now we have Jude Law's almost pitch-perfect Hamlet.
Let's remind people of the Jude Law that they're used to. Here he is as the supremely self-confident Dickie Greenleaf trying to shed himself of Matt Damon as the talented Mr. Ripley in the film of the same name.
You love me. You're not marrying me.
Tom, I don't love you.
No, I don't mean that as a threat.
To be honest, I'm a little relieved you're going. I think we've seen enough of each other for a while.
What?
You can be a leech. You know that. And it's boring. You can be quite boring.
Oh, Jude Law, be careful what you say to Matt Damon. What a great movie that was. And as we hear, that's Jude Law playing an American trying to sound like a preppy Brit.
Right. And now in Hamlet, he's speaking in his native tongue as a melancholy Dane.
Let's hear some of that. Here he is railing at Ophelia about the treachery of women.
You jig, and you amble, and you lisp, and you nickname God's creatures, and you make your wantonness your ignorance. Go to all no more, aunt! It has made me mad! I say we will have no more marriage. Those that are married already, all but one, shall live. The rest shall keep as they are. To a nunnery, go!
Well, and we know what happened to her, Ophelia. But Jude Law there, I mean, he has that sort of raspy voice that has made audiences kind of swoon for him. But what are we seeing there? What is the acting?
Well, first of all, I think it's a terrific piece of acting, if a bit relentless. Mm-hmm. You can probably sense the physicality of his performance even without seeing it. You certainly get the sense of urgency and madness from the power of his speech and the clarity of it, the soliloquies that he delivers. Even in a large theater, he makes it seem as if he's talking directly to you.
Well, let's listen to Jude Law talking about the part.
Within the part, there's also an incredible everyman journey. That he raises questions that I think all of us ask of life. To be or not to be? And he asks it in such a way that makes it incredibly therapeutic. Where be your jibes now? Your gambols? Your songs?
Ooh, Jude Law in Hamlet, now on Broadway. Sounds like must-see, hard ticket probably. Okay, let's take a look at Jude Law's countryman, Daniel Craig, and Australia's Hugh Jackman in A Steady Rain. And this Steady Rain doesn't come from London, but from?
Chicago, that wonderful theater town. It's by Keith Huff, who unfortunately is no present-day Shakespeare.
Uh-oh, foreshadowing. you don't like it?
No, I mean, imagine trying to cram a whole season's worth of NYPD Blue or The Shield into a 90-minute play. We have a police officer, played by Jackman, who gets increasingly corrupted by the company he keeps, and his longtime fellow cop is played by Craig, and the two just careen from one cliche to another. You know, I will give them credit. They're two fine stage actors, and they keep their head above water where others might have drowned.
Well, and we understand the producers are not releasing any sound from A Steady Rain, so here now our theater critic Ed Siegel with his imitation of Hugh Jackman.
Oh, no, you don't want me to go there. Though, you know, people tell me I look a lot like both of them.
But there is a YouTube posting of something?
Of Jackman staying in character as somebody's cell phone goes off.
All the time, his face. You want to get that? You want to get it? Grab it. I don't care. Grab your phone. Put it in there. Don't be embarrassed. Just grab it. We've all gone. Just grab your phone.
So I guess if you want Hugh Jackman to pay attention to you, bring your cell phone. No, that's awful with cell phones. But I could hear there, Jackman, you know, don't be embarrassed. Grab your phone. He's got sort of a Midwestern voice.
They both do a good job with their Midwestern accents.
All right, so Steady Rain, sort of a good cop, bad cop play on Broadway. And maybe it's appropriate that we move to another import from Chicago, this one called Superior Donuts. Cool. cop reference there. And this is from playwright Tracy Lett. Now, Ed, we spoke about Tracy Lett's when August Osage County opened a couple seasons ago.
That's right, and that went on to win the Tony and the Pulitzer. But, you know, Robin, you'd be hard-pressed to recognize this play as one by Tracy Letts because he's been walking kind of on the wild side from Killer Joe and Bug to Osage County, which was almost a three-hour epic of transgressive behavior. Mm. But Superior Donuts is a comedy about the owner of a donut shop. It's not Norman Rockwell territory, but by today's standards, and certainly by Letts' standards, it's kind of sweet, no pun intended. Mm-hmm. The donut man hires a young African-American wannabe novelist, and he in turn tries to make the owner, who's an aging hippie, see that life didn't end with the death of Jerry Garcia. And he's played, the owner is played, with really nice understated humor by Michael McKean of Spinal Tap fame. Here he's playing straight man to John Michael Hill, and he's excellent as the donut shop owner's assistant.
You're not giving much credit to the discernment of the consumer, African-American or otherwise.
Discernment implies a choice. You don't see no Whole Foods in this neighborhood, do you?
Oh, it's coming. You got a Starbucks right across the street.
Brother, they got Starbucks in wheat fields now.
Anyway, you don't see a lot of brothers in the Starbucks, do you?
And you ain't never seen a brother in a Whole Foods unless he's stocking the shelves.
Can you picture that? Some big, angry black man shopping in Whole Foods, his arms all loaded with soy cheese and echinacea and star fruit.
Ouch. Well, it's, you know, it's sweet, but it sounds a little more sitcom-y.
You're right. It really is kind of sitcom territory, but Letts is really an engaging writer, and he's very entertaining, and this look at lovable losers who, without giving anything away, just might be winners in the end is really recommendable.
Nothing wrong with feel good.
Exactly.
A little feel good. That's Here and Now's critic at large, Ed Siegel, with his recommendations for plays that have landed on Broadway. And we'll have the whole list for you at our website, hereandnow.org. And we'll go out with some Rolling Stones from Superior Donuts. Ed, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin. Kind of for you, so down I won't
wrap my coat around your water. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.